So, Becky, what made you decide to join Greenham Common?
Well, I was living in Kent and I was already involved in activism. And I was also living with quite a strong bunch of women. We went to Avebury quite a lot, and the political climate was getting much heavier and more apparent of, the nuclear race, the patriarchal system seemed to be coming down pretty heavy, and I felt a need to actually go and really do something. If I wanted to see change, then I had to be part of it. And that was pretty much my reason for going.
And so, Helen, what made you decide to join?
I arrived at Greenham Common in the January. And what made me arrive was the fact that I'd had a massive tragedy in my life. And so partly I was running away, but also, like Becky, I was very aware of the political situation and how we felt like we were really under this massive cloud of the nuclear button being pressed, and how the Americans were bringing the missile to this country, and I wanted to do my bit, really, and I'd done various protests before. So it was partly running away, but partly because I wanted to be active.
And so how did you two meet?
Well, we met at Greengate. I moved to Greengate in the February. My sister dropped me off in her van and left me there with a tarpaulin and a bag. And I didn't know anyone. I was quite young, 22, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite sure why I went straight to Greengate. I think we knew it was in the woods. And it was bleak at Greenham. And I think the woods had a slightly softer, more enclosed, cozier feel. And I met Helen there. That's where I met Helen. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, and I went to the Green Gate because like Becky also, I didn't know anyone living there at all. I was and I went to the Green Gate because it was bleak and it was quite hardcore, because there were camps all around the base, yellow being the main gate, and then the Green Gate was, in, like Becky said, in the woods. It felt more kind of a little bit more nurturing or something.
It wasn't exposed, was it?
It wasn't exposed to the main roads.
Yeah.
Because I think all the others were. But then, you know, we got a lot of vigilante activity at Green Gate. I think it was probably around all the others as well. But because the benders that we built, or the shelters that we built, were in the woods, it was almost like there was an invisibility about it. We got a lot of... Yeah. Do you remember the rabbits?
The rabbits. Rabbits intestines. And broken. Because there were a lot of mirrors put up. Yeah. Women put up to kind of mirror back the fence. And... It was another thing with although it was slightly kinder, more forgiving in the woods, it was also, could be not spooky, but there were a lot of, you know, there was darkness, and there used to be squatters that would come out and, do these horrible things and put, rabbits.
And locals.
Yeah, and locals.
I think it was locals that did that rather than the squatters.
And there was mirrors were put up sort of to reflect the base, and then they'd get broken. You'd hear in the night, you'd hear these smashes and stuff. I mean, actually what I ended up doing was... I was trying to find something to to get involved with, and I wasn't massively into doing the big political thing. I don't either, neither had the inclination or in the intellect to felt like to get involved, because it was quite strident, some of the camps.
Some of them,
quite strident and very political, and a lot of talking. So I was trying to find myself a role, and I don't think they did when I first moved there, which was in February, so that's 83. I don't think we did have Night Watch, and then quite soon into me being there, decided that needed someone or a couple of people to do Night Watch, someone to stay by the fire and stay up all night because of these attacks, Circuit Alert. And I fitted quite nicely into that role. I was quite... all that time I was living with people, but I sort of felt quite solo. I felt like I did quite like doing my stuff on my own. I don't know if that was my emotional state at the time. Maybe I was running away from some stuff as well. And I used to leave Greenham and do other stuff with the anti-vivisection and go and do vigils. And I always used to just go on my own. So the Night Watch thing suited me quite well. But obviously, you get burnt out. You get very burnt out, very tired. And so what I ended up doing, which suited me and it felt sustainable, was I do a week on at Greenham and do Night Watch. And then it wasn't completely set. And then I do a week off and I go back to Kent and sort of rest and recuperate, go back to sort of my nice place where I live, and then go on and off, and did that for many months. But obviously you do get tired, because even if you're doing Night Watch, you can't sleep because there's constantly evictions. We were always going, was it round to the left side? I'm not quite sure which camp it was.
To the Blue Gate,
where they had, they ended up making their benders on pallets with shopping trolley wheels to push them. And they were, I think they got evicted like every other day. They were constantly, and we'd get a call, someone would run. We had no phones, obviously, someone would run. And we'd all dash, whoever could would dash and go and help them. So there was constantly something going on. It was tiring. But there was nice stuff. I was talking to Helen earlier and remembering the Quaker women in the Green Gate who took their role as, they were the wooders, weren't they? They were constantly collecting wood and singing. They used to be a little bit like pixies.
Yes.
Pixies in the wood singing. And there was a lot of sweetness, a lot of cooking, lots of food. We never got hungry, that's for sure. Cake.
Lots
of cake.
Lots of women obviously came every day, and they would be bringing supplies and joining and finding out. So lots of talking, filling in. Just the day was full, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And the squaddies, there was a period where the squaddies were not allowing us to sleep. So they got into the sleep deprivation thing.
Yeah.
And so all night long would be bashing and clashing and making massive sounds, so you just couldn't sleep. That was one thing that they did. It was very, very joyful, women coming together, supporting each other. There were lots of levels to it, but a lot of fun. There was art stuff that happened, and then people would be going off off to London to do protests. I was involved with the Pacific nuclear testing with an Australian woman, because there was a lot of women from all over the world that came and lived there or stayed or visited, and they would bring their stories. Big discussions about because obviously we were non-confrontational, and so big debates on how certain women in South America, I think it was South America, would be armed, and with their protests, and how really in a way I felt this is personal, that I was, it was luxury not to have to be armed, and that we really, really could do it without. And maybe they could, I don't know. I would not have been able to judge it because they felt at that time that they couldn't. So, yeah, it was...
it was a very interesting
it was,
time.
Yes, it was yeah, very active, very full on. People would come and sing. And
so how long were you there for, and what made you decide to leave?
Well, I arrived in that February, and I think I must have been there about 8 months. Probably about 8 months into the next winter. Or next autumn, I think. It's hard to say. It's a long time ago. It's all a bit of a blur. There was a lot going on. I say I went back and forwards to rest. And to be honest, it was scary. It was scary. It was bleak. It was bleak. It was hardcore. It was the front line. It was constant. And... at the end, I decided to leave. There was a situation. There was an eviction, which I think we think was possibly at Yellowgate, and horrible eviction. And we'd gone round to help, and there were a lot of police, and it was very brutal. They were pushing people. Those were those ditches we saw in the photos, and they were pushing people into the ditches. And I was part of a circle who we were holding on to a makeshift bender, kind of trying to hold on to it. And a policeman came behind me and basically put me into an arm lock behind my back and lifted me up. And he was very tall and I'm quite little, and picked me off the ground with my arm behind my back like that. And I sort of screamed and said, "You're hurting," and he was like, "Good, good, I'm going to break your effing arm, I'm going to, you know." And I was scared, you know, I was scared. And I think the next day I went back and I got the coach, went to Newbury and got the coach, and I always used to buy a paper. And there was a photo on the front page of The Guardian. And there was a photo of us, which I actually need to find. I haven't got a, or if I did, I've lost it. And there was, suddenly it all came a bit real. There was on the front page of the newspaper, got onto the coach, and which I'd got loads of times before, and got attacked on the coach to London by a bunch of youths, girls and boys, who threw burning ashtrays. When the times when people could smoke on the coach, threw burning ashtray into my lap, pulled my hair, kicked me, called me names, and I went to the bus driver, the coach driver, and asked him to help me, and I won't repeat what he said to me. And I got really scared actually. I felt that I was being followed, which I talked to Helen about. I think I got followed back to Kent. And I just got the feeling, and I'm pretty much sure I did get followed by an authoritarian figure. And I got scared that I was going to be set up for something. Because people were getting said, a lot of people were being arrested. And I felt that I was going to get set up for something that I hadn't actually really done. And I felt that I was also doing, as I said, I think people were involved in other stuff, you know, and I'd gone to the March at Aldermoss, which actually there was nothing untoward happened there. It was all a huge amount of people and real diverse, a huge amount of people did the walk to Aldermaston. But there was Stop the Cities had started in London, and I'd gone there, and there was just a feeling that you could just get picked up. I got the feeling I could, and I was also lived the place I lived in Kent. It was quite, it was community, and by this time, the state were fighting back against us. Yeah. We weren't just a bunch of hippies sort of making the world go. We were seen as a massive threat, and I just felt that I was going to get picked up and popped into a cell and sort of forgotten about, because I said I was quite on my own. I was quite an insular little activist, I think, bobbing around doing my sort of bit in the world. And I still, you know, we were young, really young. And I got scared. I got really scared, actually. I got really scared. And I had to, I didn't stop being, but I didn't stop being an act, but I had to come off the front line.
Yeah,
that's how I felt. I had to come because something was going to happen. And I just sort of had a bad omen
well,
in my head.
Well, it got very, very heavy, didn't
yeah.
it? Well, you know, with the miners' strike.
Yeah.
And you know, and I, the authorities were at that point, I think, being very threatened.
Yeah, and they were
by because I think
they were plucking people off.
Yeah,
they were plucking people
they were.
Off. And I remember being at a Stop the City, which obviously was quite a different thing from Greenham, and being at the Stop the City march and in London, and us all getting, I think it's called Kettledon, we all just got shoved in, and it was really scary. And people had kids and buggies and stuff. And I had managed to climb up onto some sort of monument to get out of the way. And I had an overall view. And there were the police vans, an old-fashioned police van, and I could just see them plucking people like you do. And then it becomes real. It suddenly becomes really scary when you see that actually happening. Plucking people and them just going to van and the van going off. And there being such an amount of chaos and confusion and fear and people that no one actually saw who went or where they went.
I think that was the tactic wasn't it?
Because, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, I do, totally.
Terrifying, actually.
Because while that sort of thing didn't really happen to me, I think because I was solidly there, that's what we were hearing.
Yeah.
And also because, you know, all the actions I did while I was living there with the groups of women that were on the whole living there. And, you know, there were always court cases, you know, and we were always being arrested. I just seemed to be very lucky. I never got taken to prison, but friends of mine did. We were always visiting Holloway because that's often where the women were sent. But I think the authorities were getting threatened. And so they were. So then they started to do this fear tactic.
Yeah,
to
and it
try
worked.
And break,
yeah.
break it up
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
And yeah.
How were the women treated in Holloway if you went to visit them?
I think on the whole they were treated okay, and I think a lot of the other prisoners. I mean, I wasn't there. I only know this secondhand. I think the other women inmates. You know, there was, I'm not going to say admiration, but they knew that they were there for a cause. And so, as I understand, I think on the whole it was okay.
And how long were you at the camp for, and what made you decide to leave
there? I was there, as I said, I arrived January in the snow and made myself a shelter. I left, I think, it is a bit sketchy.
Yeah.
I think I left around November, so not quite a year. And I left because I was burnt out, because of basically just living there constantly. I think periodically I'd go and stay at you know, another Greenham woman's house. They were like little refuges. And I think, but I only remember doing it once, going to stay with somebody in Oxford. And I think I just really remember just how burnt and tired I was. And probably that I needed to get back and sort my own life out. And you know, carry on doing the work in a more local way, actually. I lived in Devon. So, yeah, carrying on and just doing... you know, marches and activism down here and talking to people, you know, in on that level.
And did you know anything about Greenham before you went there?
I had heard of Greenham. I think to be fair, I'd been up there for a day with a bunch of friends and... because, you know, everyone was kind of talking about it. Well, not everyone, but, you know, certain circles of women were talking about it. And so, yeah, I think I went up as a, you know, to bring food and support and to join, you know, kind of walking around the base and cutting the fence.
Was it what you expected it to be?
I don't think I had any expectations, to be honest. I just really don't think I did. I think I just went, saw what was happening, and then went back home, and then just thought, actually, I had this terribly big, strong pull. I think I just need to live there and just be there on the ground. And like I say, I wasn't a big academically political person. Otherwise, I'd have perhaps gone to the Yellow Gate, but I went to the Green Gate, where there it was very, very multicultural.
Is that what attracted you to the Green Gate?
I think so. And just like Becky says, it wasn't like it was a softer option, but it was.
There were trees. There were trees, and I can't express the fact that there were trees made a thing because otherwise it literally was the fence.
Yeah. The squaddies, and you know, and roads.
I don't know if we were seen as a bit soft, because I think we probably were a bit. You know, the softies, because the other women, some of the camps, I've been again looking at the photos, it was so grim. So grim. But even at the Green Gate, there's a sketch I've got in my sketchbook, which is actually my recipe book, and there's a very faded sketch of a cooking pot by the fire, and in that, and you can just see the fence. The fence was everywhere, wasn't it?
It was. It was our daily bread, wasn't it?
Someday I used to, my constitution, I used to walk the base. How many miles was it? It was 11 miles or something.
I think it was about 11.
11 miles. I used to walk the base. So that was quite a few cups of tea, and you'd stop and walk the base. Used to do that on a
Sunday. Did you know about Greenham before you went?
I'd gone to the art college, and where I'd gone on a coach, and I'd gone to a couple of maybe the beginning of the Embrace of Base. I remember seeing a poster sort of calling Greenham women, and I had I just had this thing, I wanted to get involved, and quite a few people around me didn't seem to be that interested, and I had a fire to that burnt to go and do something and take direct action, because I didn't feel that I was making much impact on what I could do by doing what I was doing at home and art college and stuff. I just felt that, so which is why I just got up and went.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, if something needs doing, go and do it. And it felt like Green Women were calling me, and it was like, go and do my bit.
It was a strong calling, yeah, wasn't it? It was a very, and I felt privileged because, in a way, that I felt I could donate that time of myself.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't working at that point, you know, or I just, you know, I was able just to give up my life and go as well.
Yeah.
It was the other thing.
I mean, I found it interesting. There was an amazing amount of the diversity of women. I remember talking to a woman who was living in the camp, and she lived somewhere, I would say, let's say it was Gloucestershire. She lived somewhere nice. She had a cottage. She was a potter. She was an artist, and she was married, and her husband was a sculptor or something. It sounded like they had a lovely life. They had chickens and, you know, a small holding, and sort of woman I sort of aspired to be. And, you know, I think maybe she was middle-aged, grown-up children, and she was living, you know, amongst these puddly, grimy puddles and, you know, stuff, and had gone down to Greenham to fight the cause with everyone. And I just felt a little bit of a fraud, because I was a young, kind of youthful punk who could really kind of had that whole, I saw it as a privilege to be an activist or to shout about, you know, what I thought was the rights and wrongs of the world. You know, I was kind of footloose and fancy free. I didn't have any responsibilities apart from myself. And so I felt, yeah, you know, take responsibility for what you think. And I was quite in awe and of women who actually were making massive sacrifices. Mm. I wasn't really making a sacrifice as far as I could see. You know, a few people said, oh, it's terribly noble of what you're doing. And it was like, just do what you do. But when I met women who were grandmothers, you know, had come from a long way away, people from abroad and other parts of the country with very nice lives, and had taken a choice to live, you know, none of the structure. Yeah, in the mud, when none of the structures had wood burners, no. We were pretty.
It was cold.
It was pretty rough.
Yeah, no, it was rough. It was just bits of plastic.
Maybe we didn't feel. I don't remember being really cold. We ate a lot and we wore a lot of jumpers.
Lots of clothes, and you know, and of course, when the evictions came, you know, even those little bits of those spare jumpers and things, they were all being taken away constantly. Yeah. So you were being stripped.
Yeah.
Constantly. That was the other sort of side of it that was. That led to burnout, didn't it?
So how and why do you think the decision was taken for Greenham to become a women-only camp?
I don't know if I can answer that, no, because I think, you know, that because it was originally, it was a mixed group, wasn't it, that walked from Wales, as I understand. So why, I don't know, sorry.
Pass. It made perfect sense to me. I mean...
Yeah.
Why did it make perfect sense to you?
Well, okay, this is not a political... I was sort of living on and off in a community type situation and mixed... So it's a communities type situation, and which ran really well. It was lovely, very supportive. And but when I got to Greenham, I felt, I don't know about the other gates, but I felt in Greengate that it was the most perfect anarchy I'd ever met, I'd ever been involved with, which is was the true meaning of the word of anarchy, of self responsibility. That it had that whole feel that you have when you're with a bunch of women, when you're, you know, here and now, you're with a bunch of women, of friends, cooking food, and it's like intuitive. No one just knows. You're cooking food with your friends, and everyone just knows what to do. It's just a women thing. I mean, maybe men have it together, I don't know. Mm. But you just have this thing, and everything gets done, and... You know, someone's lit the fire or someone's done that. You don't have to ask. It just gets done. We just seem to have this amazing knack. Women together have this amazing knack. And I remember thinking that and remembering that when I lived at Greengate, that you didn't have to worry about things not getting done, that there wasn't going to be someone was going to have the pot on, the kettle was going to be on, the wood was going to be collected. You know, things were going to get done. It just happened organically, and I think that made it very strong and safe, considering how brutal the actual situation was. But we did it. Yeah. We did it.
And men did come and visit. Yeah. Not actually the camp itself, but men did come and support. But why it was originally, I don't know.
And what sort of relationship did you or the other women have with the men around, you know, the military or the police or partners and bailiffs?
Not good.
Well, it was individual because of the anarchy nature. You know, I mean, there were no rules. It was absolutely individual, you know, how a woman responded to any one of those situations. But essentially, it was non-violent, and you know, I think there were lots of women that talked to the squaddies, you know, because some of them were really young themselves, and just, you know, just lots of debate. Some were more open to that, some were not.
I remember a couple of women who almost, it was their little mission, didn't they? Used to go round, especially in the evening when they used to change shift. I can't remember their names, but there was a couple of women and they used to go and talk, have debates and try and... And I think they did actually, I've got a weird, vague feeling in my head somewhere of remembering of them, not breaking him down in a horrible way, but... talking, willing him round, a young lad, and he was really young, you know, like 17, 18, 19, I don't know, but young, under 20, and him sort of breaking down and sort of going, I don't want to do this anymore. And then them saying, you don't have to. And him running away screaming, running away from him.
Yeah, but the, I mean, obviously, with the police and the bailiffs, I mean, that was another story. I mean, you know, it wasn't that there was any violence because, you know, it was peaceful. But, you know, I think on the whole, women tried to just be, you know, peaceable.
But of course we did get the whole thing, you know, that...
We got their aggression.
We got their aggression and there was a whole thing, you know, we were in those ways that we were despised and ridiculed, you know. We were all smelt of smoke and we were grubby and so, you know, we were these...
Dirty lesbians,
you know, and the ridicule and... I mean, that's what the situation on that coach that I said earlier, you know, that's of being... Which was quite hard when you're on your own on a coach.
Yeah.
It was quite hard and being beaten up, it was pretty scary and I got hurt. They did hurt me. But it was that taunting of, you know, of how disgusting and, you know, fat, ugly, shaven-headed, lesbian, dykish, just to kind of break you down. And but when you're with a bunch of women, you're strong and water off when you're isolated. I think that's what I was going back to, where I sort of the fear of actually getting separated and incarcerated on my own and no one knowing where I was quite frightening. Because suddenly you seem very little, whereas when you're with a bunch, even if you're not don't know everyone, you've got this strength of solidarity.
Yeah.
When there was Embrace the Base day, I don't know if you, where you were, Helen, at that point, there was a big fire, and they had a big fire and women were singing. I think someone had died and there was a lot of keening and singing and... No surprises, it was a full moon and everyone rushed from the fire. I can't remember where exactly, it wasn't Acreen, I'm not sure which part of the fence it was on, this massive bonfire. And then everyone kind of naturally, organically rushed to the fence and we brought it down. And just everyone rattling it. I'm just not sure where that came from or where it's going. But this sort of surge of any, or what I was saying was being isolated, and then suddenly this, you know, solidarity of women together, and we can do it. And actually, I do remember it really clearly actually, because I remember everyone running to the fence, and pulling and it just beginning to web, and the concrete posts, which were massive, just beginning to go.
Loosen.
Yeah. And then running, and obviously behind the base, it's all flat, and there were being Land Rovers suddenly zooming up, and then them all rushing out with great razor wire, like massive, like freaking out, because we were actually bringing part of that fence down. Which is why we've all got bits of fence.
Yep.
Yes, I'm fascinated as I'm sitting round your kitchen table, Becca, and I'm looking at a piece of the fence. Did you actually cut that out?
I'd cut that out. Mm-hmm. And what is interesting, this morning, Helen arrived and we're chatting and looking at photos and the sketches and the it's all got the fence in, and most of them got the fence. And I said, I know, in my kitchen drawer, I think I've got a bit of the fence. And amongst my kitchen, in my kitchen drawer, amongst very kitchen drawer things, like screwdrivers and sellotape, is no other memorabilia, is all sentimental stuff, is a part of Greenham Common Fence. In 2019, I find that quite odd. Why that is in my kitchen drawer. Why is that in my kitchen drawer? I haven't put it there sort of as a kind of show. It's just in my kitchen drawer.
And you've also got your wire cutters.
And my wire cutters, which my sister bought me for my 23rd birthday. They're not those great big bolt cutters. They're more discreet. She brought them for me, and when she gave them to me, so that was in March. I arrived there in February, so that was the next month. And she gave them to me, and they're not the big bolt croppers, they're wire cutters to snip, snip, because you can put them in your pocket. Because the big bolt croppers, you had to have big coats for those.
You did.
Those, is that what you're talking about, the black coats?
The black, I think they were called the black, black cardigans.
No, I don't know.
It was something like that. They definitely had a name, and I feel embarrassed. I can't quite remember.
Well, it was a long time ago. It's all a very long time ago.
So, how did the experiences of the camp change your relationship with men or authority as you look back over the years?
To be honest, I don't think I had a massive regard for authority before. So, to be really honest, I'm not sure it changed a lot, to be honest. Other than that I felt, you know, as a group, you could really, really change things. And that felt good. Relationship with men. I was always bisexual, so my relationships with men, I think, didn't really change. You know, I mean, I ended up having relationships with men before and after. And I have, you know, a lot of respect for men, but there is just something very magical about, you know, being with women, and there's a safety in that. On the whole, not always, obviously. So, yeah, I don't think my experience there actually changed who I became or what I believed. I think it was just a massive experience in my life that, obviously has made me a bit who I am. But, I'm waffling. Becky. Mm.
Sam, I don't think it changed anything. What was the question again?
So, how have the experiences of the camp changed your relationship with men or authority figures?
No. Again, I think the experience of Greenham, maybe shaped me, and gave me strength and wised me up to authority maybe a little bit, but I don't think it, because we were part of Greenham Camp. It wasn't that Greenham Camp was, we just came, everyone was, came into, that's, I mean, there was always the first women that set up, but we were Greenham Common Women. So it'd be like saying, did you change yourself? We were part of that. Mm. So I don't really understand the question. Sorry.
Okay, and so you talked a little bit earlier on about your relationship with local residents and the fact that you thought that they were doing horrible things. So could you tell me a little more about that? What was your relationship with the local residents? And
I think we had a lot of local residents that supported.
Yeah, I was going to say that. There was a woman that came and she did almost Meals on Wheels.
Yeah, that's right.
Especially to that, is it the Yellow Gate that was really stark?
Yeah.
And I think there was a couple of local women that used to provide dinners because they were...
On the verge.
And there was only a few. They were on a... It was tiny, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, there was... And it was a really small camp. There were only about 10 of them, 15 of them. I don't remember them being many. I mean, obviously, I was only there for that short period. But they often didn't have... it was very stark where they were. They were on just a little bit. So they didn't really have anywhere. They tried to make little places for them to hide their stuff. But they were so exposed, there wasn't anywhere to hide. So they often had nothing. So they often wouldn't have any fire. And that was the camp that I said that they made. It was very ingenious that they ended up making their benders on a pallet, which then had trolley wheels on it.
Yeah.
But I'm not trying to digress too much. But I remember there was a kind of a local women that. Used to do, it was, and they said they would be the greener Meals on Wheels, and they used to go and take food, hot floss of soup and stuff, to make sure that the women on that gate got fed. I think it's like anywhere, there's a split, isn't it? I think it's like any area of any region, you're going to get people who are
pro and against.
You're going to, you know... I think that's just the way the way it was called demographic works, isn't it?
Yeah, because people did come and offer their showers and baths, didn't they? That you know from Newbury.
Yeah.
So that.
And I think they probably had. I think there were. I wasn't because I said I used to try not get. I didn't like getting involved in stuff. I think I felt involved enough. But there were women, there were Greenham women who were quite involved in the local Newbury stuff, politics and women's groups, and used to go into the library and who were quite involved and made friends with families and stuff. And there were people.
Yeah. You know, I made friends with some of the families.
Yeah, I think that happened, and then you're always going to get. And then there was a whole redneck element.
Yeah.
But that's. That's going to be.
So what was that about?
Well, that served, you know, locals and, you know, filthy lesbian Greenham nutters, you know. We should all be, you know.
Hanged up.
Or you know, burnt, yes. Incinerated, you know, and we were scum, you know. So there's. But I think it's not particularly.
Depending which side of the fence you were on.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to put that in.
And so what?
But the vigilantes, I was just going to say, the vigilantes obviously were local men on the whole. I think it was more them that did it from my memory and understanding. That it was that was their protest to get rid of the Greenham women.
Yeah,
let's make it as horrible as possible.
It's not rocket science that and situations like that. Seen as a, you know, women seen as like that as seen as a massive threat.
Yeah.
Just a massive threat. I mean, that's centuries old.
Yeah.
Centuries old. And probably still is, I think, you know, it's probably ongoing that women and to be rid of, so that the most basic tactic is to isolate people and then ridicule them.
Yeah.
And make them feel inadequate and dirty and vile and inhuman is a way of breaking it down. But it's actually, they're terrified that they're going to steal their wives and their daughters and turn them all into strident feminists. You know, what could be worse for a lot of men, or some men?
And what were the challenges of being a child on the camp?
Well, we weren't grown up.
There were children there.
Yeah, there were a few children there. I don't think there are any children living there. In my memory, there weren't children living there. There were children that would perhaps come and visit and perhaps stay for short periods of time.
I remember there being a van, and there was a woman with a couple of kids, and she'd come periodically.
Yeah.
It wasn't really encouraged, I don't think, because I think the authorities would have been down pretty heavy.
It wasn't really a safe place.
No.
So there weren't many children?
No, not there. That I remember at all.
There weren't any children living in Greengate while I was there.
I think, you know, on big...
I think a couple of people had some dogs and nothing to do with children, but I remember there was a couple of people had some dogs, but if it wasn't, it was just people. It was it wouldn't have been really responsible.
Mm.
You had to be ready to...
of a baby.
Oh.
But she was a local woman, and she came, she used to come in the evenings sometimes and bring her baby.
Yeah.
So it was that sort of thing. So visit and then away.
Yes.
And yes, I think some people did stay, like you say, in a van and with their children.
What medical treatment was available at the camp, if any?
One of the women at Greengate while I was living there was a doctor. She was from Australia, I think. But no, if you needed medical attention, you went to the surgery at Newbury.
Mm. So, how do you feel about the way Greenham has been represented in popular culture? And films and books and plays.
I haven't seen much. I'd like to say I haven't seen much, and like I've sort of said earlier, I mean, talking to the young people, I think a lot of people don't even know that it kind of particularly exists, I think.
Yeah. Even my children, my son, it sees it as a sort of heroic thing I did a very long time ago.
Yeah. I haven't... I mean, I've seen some things online, but yeah, I feel it's under-publicised, that's the word.
So how would you like to see it publicised?
By scary little girls. I think it needs to be documented, and I think it needs... It does... How do I want it publicised? Oh, gosh, I might have to think about that.
Yeah.
Because
Well, I think an exhibition would be amazing with photos and what it's archives, isn't it? I mean, I've got some very faded sketches, as I said in my recipe book. I cannot be the only person who's got... Helen's turned up with a huge amount of photographs. I haven't got any photographs. So if we're just two women... There were a lot of women there. There must be a lot of information and recorded information, not just verbal anecdotes. And for that to be compiled is just incredible. I mean, it's been great for the women itself, but it's a part of history. It's part of, you know, part of the suffragette movement. It's a big thing.
So why do you think the suffragettes have had all that publicity? And the women at Greenham Common haven't.
Well, I'd like to know.
Because we're still alive.
Yeah, probably it is. It's probably to do with that. You know, this is relatively recent history. You know, we changed, you know, the missile did go. You know, it worked. Mm. I suppose because of the anarchy of it, you know, the governments, they're not going to want that exposed. You know, that actually, if you really, really want to do something, you can do it. You know, that's the kind of essence, isn't it, of Greenham, of what happened at Greenham. You know, women believed it would. We were going to get rid of this oppression.
Don't you feel that? I don't know. I've been just sort of vaguely following stuff with the climate change and the children's movement that's going on worldwide.
Yeah.
And I've just been seeing little snippets. I'm not following it massively. Maybe I should. And I've got a slight feeling this is a kind of same kind of momentum being picked up by possibly ridiculed. Although it does, yeah, possibly ridiculed children saving the planet and speaking up, and it's going worldwide, and I think I'm not sure how I'm tying this anything of this together, but it's
Hopefully it'll snowball. It snowballs, and something will happen.
That just as Helen said, that you know that it made it happen, and I feel that there is not. So this is, you know. It's a weaker part of society. So women all together doing something fantastic, and children do it. Are women on their own going to be able to disarm a base and stop a base? And you know, yeah, we did. Are children going to be able to save the planet? Probably yes. I can't think of anyone else who's going to. Let the children save the planet. I'm not let the children save the planet, but, you know, leave it up to them. It's a powerful movement.
So what tactics, then, from Greenham do you still see in play in activism and politics today?
Oh, that's quite intellectual. This is the sort of thing that I always used to run away, these kind of debates.
I was fascinated by what you were just saying about you're noticing in the world today that something is happening. And so, you know.
Well, it's that thing. If you need something doing, you just got to go and do it. If you need something doing, I mean, why did I go to Greenham? Was because I'd heard about it. I was already involved in it's not politics, but I'm an environmentalist. And it felt like instead of talking about it or going on the odd days, people were beginning to live it, so to go and live it, and there was, you know, and people were going to peace camps. It was a way of getting things done, and I think, there's also, from what I'd see, there's quite a lot of people involved in the environmental stuff going on now. It seems people are quite involved in doing stuff on a grassroots, on a ground level, getting on, cleaning up your own backyard, so involved in local politics, or whether it's gardening projects. There's a feeling of that as well, of homegrown stuff. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense. I'm beginning to waffle as well now.
So how well do you believe the Greenham legacy has been relayed down through the generations? And if you don't think it's been done well, what differences would you like to see?
In a way, I feel it's like the question before. I just want to see that it would be great to get a good documentation of people's lives and stories and photos out there, logged,
And do you think if that had been done, it would have made a difference to where we are now?
Probably not.
And the view?
I'd say probably not.
Probably. No.
I think it'd just be great to have it documented, because people are still alive. Because it is a long journey, isn't it? You know, the Ordermaston marches. You know, there's lots going way, way back, and this is just one part of a massive, massive story. And as you've just said, Becky, the moving on with the children, hopefully you know, making big moves in, you know, saving our planet. But it actually is only ever going to happen with the individual.
Yeah.
With the individual, you know, coming from that place where they are driven, and I will use the word, you know, it's heartfelt.
I don't feel that there's anything lost, even though the maybe now, I mean, I think there has been stuff documented, but there's with this project that it might seem, is it a bit late in the day? But from, I got told about the project from a friend who wasn't at Greenham, who I got an email from a friend from Kent, who I knew as a teenager, and said, do you know any Greenham women? So she immediately got to me. And it's really interesting, the links and the opening up and me and Helen getting back in touch. As I don't think I've said this on this interview, that I have Helen in my phone book, nothing the way before the project, and she's down as Helen Greenham.
Yes,
in my, so the, it's not like this legacy doesn't live. I have a bit of Greenham in my kitchen drawer, my bit of Greenham. It's quite weird. You know, it's not, hasn't died. And what I was going to say when I got in touch, so when I wrote to Rebecca about the project, said I was interested, I didn't hear anything back from her because she and the other woman had got so inundated with response, and Greenham women are everywhere,
and
want to speak out, and have probably a lot of women have got little bits of fence in their kitchen drawer or in their side table or whatever. You know, it's not like a dead thing. It's not a dead thing.
Yes. And as well as your bit of fence, you've got a recipe book.
I have a recipe book.
So, are those recipes that you cooked at Greenham?
Oh. No, probably not, actually. I don't want to be fake. I think we probably had one pot stew, didn't we, most of the time?
Mostly, yeah.
But there is a picture of the cooking pan and the fence at Greengate. And, yes, there you are, in rainbow pencil.
How does it make you feel when you have looked at the photographs together this morning and looked at the pictures in the recipe book.
One of me with my head cut off, but she did recognise my legs.
Cropped.
And a friend of mine who didn't live there, so that must have been, that photo must have been Embrace Base. And nice to see an old friend of mine that had lived at that community years ago who is a herbalist now and runs a whole food shop and does lots of witchy herbalism stuff. So, you know, the movement lives on.
And I think for me, it's lovely revisiting the photos and the memorabilia and talking it through with Becky and just remembering people's names. I mean, I don't know probably anybody's second name, but I am slightly recalling some of the first names. And
it's taken us a while, but we managed to actually muster which year it was, because I thought it was 82 and it was
83.
You know, it's only kind of talking about it that you remember bits and bobs.
And I've shown this album to other friends that have who came to visit Greenham. And they've sort of said, Helen, I never even knew you had that album. And I was like, yeah, I know. It's just been in my, you know, on my shelf. So it's lovely to revisit it. And it is a massive part of our pasts. And I think revisiting it and, you know, and hopefully more young women and men that get to know about it can only be for good. It's like I went to see a play about the, you know, what happened at the bean field, and then there was a bit of a resurgence about that, and I just thought, great, that happened. That was the police brutality. It happened. I wasn't at the Beanfield, but I was, I saw those vehicles and people, traumatised a week later. So, that movement's there. We don't know each other individually, but we do know each other. It's like Becky. I don't know Becky, but I feel like I know her.
We are very connected.
I feel like I know her very well.
And finally,
I feel very... Do you know how it makes me feel? I'm very proud to be a Greenham woman. I feel very proud of that. And, I do. I feel very proud to have stood up, actually, to have been brave. You had to be quite brave.
Yeah,
you had to be quite brave.